Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco-Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And you know what, guys? There was a time where I was absolutely enthralled with pirates. But those were pirates on the high seas. When I was in college, there was a totally different type of piracy that was running rampant across the networks, and that was the theft of intellectual property. So today, we're taking a classic look at how Napster worked. Now, this episode originally published on April 3rd, 2013. So let's listen to this classic episode of Tech Stuff.
Napster. And Napster is it's got a bad rap. It's kind of become synonymous with at least the old Napster, the original Napster, has become synonymous with things like piracy.
And the lawless days of the internet, yes, when everyone just stole from Lars Ulrich.
Yes. In fact, he ended up delivering a lawsuit by hand.
Full of ire he was that, yes, he took this, I think it was,
they said 60,000 pages. I don't know that even a member of Metallica can carry a 60,000 page.
Maybe by hand truck? I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure by hand, but sure.
Maybe
it could have been on CD.
Series of CDs, yeah. So anyway, let's talk about Napster, right, and what it was and what it is today, because it's definitely changed quite a bit. So it's all about music. It's technically about file sharing, but those files were essentially music files, MP3 files.
Napster limited itself to MP3 files. Lots of other peer-to-peer sharing networks used, you know, you could get movies on, right, there, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, you could, games, everything, any kind of file. Mm-hmm. Well, Napster was all about MP3s. And you have to understand, like, the days when we first start looking at this idea, that's way back in the late 90s. Back then, music was not something that you could easily get on the internet. It was, first of all, anything that was on a web page was MIDI based or whatever. It was,
right,
or mod based. It was just, it was not anywhere close to CD quality.
We didn't have an iTunes store, that kind of thing.
Yeah. There wasn't, you know, but there were people
Did I just say completely? I just said that.
When iTunes was founded, that's a different show.
Excellent.
So anyway, there's a whole, you know, iTunes for a long time was just a jukebox type of program where you would manage the music that you already had. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a store where you would buy new music. It was a management system. So really at this time, the way you would get, if you were someone who wanted to get a music file, you would essentially have to search around for someone who was hosting music files on a website somewhere, mm-hmm. and then download them. And these websites were very much unreliable.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what got a certain guy thinking about different ways of going about it. The guy's name was Sean Fanning.
Yeah. And as of 1997, he got his first computer, and very shortly after that, created Napster. So that was...
Yeah. It was within 2 years he had gone from getting his first computer to creating one of the most influential and notorious web services and programs of all time.
Mm-hmm.
He got his computer from his uncle, John Fanning, mm-hmm. Who ended up being
a
big supporter.
He provided the seed money for Napster in a couple of years.
Yeah. He was also not just interested in programming right off the bat, but also interested in Internet Relay Chat, IRC, which mm-hmm. is, you know, one of many different protocols that allow you to communicate over the Internet. And
in an instant messenger kind
yes,
of way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly, as opposed to like email or
right.
something along those lines. And he got interested in the field of Internet security. And he described himself at the time as a white hat, not a hacker. So the idea
right.
being that he was interested in finding ways to make Internet security more robust.
Mm-hmm.
So if
and
you
in,
were
and in helping people, not stealing from people.
Right. Like
not. Yeah.
You know, like he might look at a system and say, oh, you have a vulnerability here. You need to patch it, as opposed to, oh, you have a vulnerability here. Give me all your things.
Right.
That was kind of his at least that's what he said. And I have no reason to doubt him. But he met virtually a fellow named Sean Parker online in those days. And Sean Parker also becomes important in the Napster story. So in 98, he was starting to think about this thing that about music files.
And by the way, this kid is a teenager. I mean, you know, if I'm using the word kid, it's not just because I use that word for everybody. It's because he was literally like 17 to 19 at the time.
Yeah, he was in 1998. He was that was when he was 18, turning 19. And he was a freshman at Northeastern University in Boston. And he knew that there were a lot of kids his age really interested in music, and they really wanted to find more music. But again, it was really tricky to find it online, because these websites that would host files, they wouldn't last very long. Maybe someone stops monitoring it or maintaining it, and the links are all dead.
Mm-hmm.
Or because of high traffic, you know, everyone finds out that this is where this one file is. Everyone goes there, and then it crashes the site.
Yeah.
It was really, really tricky to find a way to reliably get those music files.
Mm-hmm. Also important to note, in 1998, that was when the Digital Millennium Copyright Act went into effect.
Yes, very important. That's Congress enacted that, and that was essentially Congress's way of saying, we understand that intellectual property is important, that copyright is important, and that the Internet age has dramatically changed how easy it is to distribute material that is under copyright. So here are some rules to guide how we can legislate this sort of stuff.
It essentially criminalized the circumvention of any kind of digital rights management
right.
measures.
It also, however, created something called Safe Harbor, which was very important and would become extremely important in Napster's case. Safe Harbor is a concept whereby it says, if your site or service is not actively engaged in copyright infringement, but the users are using your service in order to conduct copyright infringement, you yourself are not at fault. You cannot be held at fault for the behavior of your users, because the users are behaving however they want to behave. You're providing a service. As long as your service is not actively meant to circumvent copyright protection or to distribute copyright materials illegally, then you should be in the clear, because you cannot be held responsible for what other people do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important concept. It's also one that ultimately you could argue was not held up in the case of Napster.
Yeah, yeah. While we're on the subject, other concept that became important in this argument was the Audio Home Recording Act of 1992, which said that you are allowed to make unlimited copies, essentially, of any CDs and cassettes that you own for personal use and for your friends, as long as you're not receiving compensation.
Right. So, again, the idea being that if I own something, I can make a copy of it. Usually it's considered a copy for backup purposes. So, for example, let's say I own a CD and I want to be able to make a second CD in case something happens to that first one, because, I mean, I bought that CD.
It's yours.
That's mine. Mm-hmm. This is something that the music industry was not so pleased about. I mean, every industry, whenever any sort of invention has come up that allows people to copy material some way, for instance, VCRs and DVRs, the various industries get very nervous about it because they're afraid that, well, for multiple reasons, but one of the reasons is they are afraid that that's going to impact sales.
Yeah.
That it means that you're going to end up distributing stuff and then you cut out the person or entity that is in charge of distributing that, and then they
lose
money.
That owns the copyright and that paid to make this thing happen, essentially, and that they're going to lose money. Yeah. It's a huge, huge thing when VCRs came out in the early 80s, not that I remember, but,
Why are you looking at me, Lauren? Is it only because I'm your co-host, or is it because you actually know that I remember when VCRs came out?
The smile
on her face tells me the answer. All I need to know, folks. All I need to know.
Anyway, so that's kind of the state of digital copyright as
right.
of 1998.
So, meanwhile, Sean Fanning is saying maybe there's a better way of being able to find and get the music files that you really want. And he starts to come up with this idea where the idea would be to create a centralized server, and that server's job would be to search for and index music files. And the way it would work is that you would subscribe to the service. You would essentially register yourself as a user with the service. And then as a registered user, you would get a folder that you would put on your hard drive, and that folder would be a shareable folder. Anything you put in that folder could be seen by
the service.
The centralized server could see whatever you put in there. Now, in the case of Napster, we're talking MP3 files. So if you had MP3 files already on your machine and you put them in this folder, it would mean that those would be discoverable by that centralized server. So someone else who registers with it wasn't called Napster yet, but when they register with the service and they search for a particular music file and you happen to have that music file in your folder, a link to essentially your machine would pop up, and the server would facilitate a connection between the person searching and your computer so that the file transfer could complete. So Lauren, we'll use ourselves as an example.
Okay.
Lauren, let's say that you've heard about this band called Common Rotation.
Okay.
All right. Common Rotation, fronted by Adam Bush, former actor in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer series.
Right, right. Yeah, he was Warren.
He was Warren, Nerd of Doom. So, Lauren, you've heard of Common Rotation, and you're thinking, I really want to hear this one song I've heard about that Common Rotation does. It's called Sit Down Before I Fall Down. But I don't have access to a way of finding this song otherwise. I go into Napster. It turns out that I, Jonathan, happen to have that song, and I have it in the share folder for Napster. And when you do the search, it points a link toward my direction, toward my computer.
Okay.
You hit the download button. My computer uploads the file and your computer downloads the file, and it's a direct transfer between the two computers. The centralized server just acts as kind of a traffic monitor.
Okay.
And the cool thing about this is that when my file gets to you, by default, it's going into your share folder. You can change those settings, or you could have changed those settings back in the day, because service doesn't exist anymore.
Right, right. Or you can pull it out of that share folder if you wanted to.
Right. But you don't have to share everything you get. But if you did, that would mean that now there's another instance of that file that
exists.
There's
two locations, so that if you have trouble accessing the first location, or if the connection peters out.
Yeah, or if I'm not even online. Mm-hmm. Like if my computer is off, you cannot connect to my computer. But if Lauren is on and she still has that file in her folder, that means person number three could come in and get the file from Lauren. So every time that someone used Napster, they were actually increasing its utility.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a service that got stronger the more people used it, and the larger the numbers joined, the more powerful this service became.
Right, right. And so early in 1999, Sean Fanning was developing this program and coding everything along with Sean Parker, I think.
Yeah, and there's a story that he did 60 straight hours of coding without sleep.
That sounds like one of those terrific internet myths. Although with, you know, with energy drinks, which were new.
The Red Bull was brand new and they were downing them in cases.
They were. But so they uploaded this beta to a website called download.com and it hit really big. People were so excited about it.
Yeah, it very quickly became clear that this thing that they had come up with was going really resonated really because there were a lot of people who were really interested in music. And there was also this growing attitude of, if I like one song, but I don't like the rest of the album, why should I buy the whole album for one song?
Sure.
And the problem at that time was that there was no real way to buy song by song.
Unless a band had released specifically a single CD or a cassette.
Right. Other than that, you were pretty much out of luck. You had to buy the entire album. And so that was why a lot of people were turning, one of the reasons why a lot of people were turning to piracy, because it allowed them the freedom to get what they wanted without getting all the other stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the big arguments people have put forward about, you know, the piracy thing is that if the music industry had moved faster to make it more of
more
accessible.
Possible. Sure, yeah. If the music industry had been moving ahead of the population at the time, or thinking ahead, or even just looking at the internet at that time, which they really weren't.
Yeah, then they could have headed off the whole piracy issue to a large extent. Like, if you make it easy for people to get your stuff, and then people will come and pay for your stuff. If, however, it's way easier for people to steal your stuff,
don't be surprised
when it gets stolen.
Yeah, I have ideas about HBO's content like this, cable television in general. And
yeah, that's one of those things where, you know, you'd be like, oh, HBO Go, I'm going to get that. And then you realize, wait a minute, if I don't have the HBO subscription, I can't.
This is useless. It's only
if I already have it. And if I already have it, why do I need it?
Anyway, that's
a whole different show.
Hey guys, it's time for me to interrupt this classic episode so that we can take a quick break to thank our sponsor.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
So back in 1999, so he had this cool idea. His Uncle John, who had gotten him that first computer, gave him some seed money and I think maybe facilitated an introduction to Eileen Richardson.
Right. And this is also around the time Sean Fanning has decided to call it Napster, which was based off a nickname he had in junior high school based on his hairstyle.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's just thought. I was like, I have to get this fact out there. And if I don't say it now, it's not going to happen. Yeah.
So Eileen Richardson was a venture capitalist.
A
very funky one. All the
punked out hair.
Right, right. Yeah. All the reports about her are like, yeah, she goes to Amsterdam to listen to bands and she's got pink hair. It's really cool.
Yeah. So clearly she's hardcore.
She invested in the company and signed on as the interim CEO.
Yes.
In mid-1999.
Exactly. She was someone who had a lot of experience in investing in internet companies. And, you know, keep in mind, this is 99, so we're still talking before the big bubble crash.
Right.
It's the heady days of the internet when everyone's trying to figure out, like, there's this incredible resource. How can we use it to our best advantage? And she was one of those people who was right there on the bleeding edge,
yeah,
looking at the possibilities. And she got really excited. She was very much a passionate music fan. Mm-hmm. And so she was a music fan and a venture capitalist. Napster fell right into her wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So she jumped in. She ended up making a very substantial investment. And then, like you said, Lauren, she became the interim CEO.
Mm-hmm. By September of 1999, there were 40,000 registered Napster users.
Yep.
And it was connecting a few hundred people at a time, at any given time.
Right. And by this time, Sean Parker has gone from being an IRC buddy to a real-life buddy and is working with Fanning on this project. And it was also right around the same time that the Recording Industry Association of America, also known as the RIAA, which represents five of the major music labels. Like we're talking
the big ones.
The big ones. The ones that own everything else, essentially. Mm-hmm. Started to really tackle websites that were hosting music files that were under copyright.
Mm-hmm.
So the RIAA was actually actively seeking these sites being taken down. Now, keep in mind, Napster's circumventing all this. It's no longer looking at websites that are hosting files. It's looking directly at people's hard drives,
right,
where there's this shared folder. So while RIAA is going after all these websites, Napster's doing, you know, business like gangbusters. And when I say business, it's not really business.
Because they weren't making money.
Yeah, they had no revenue generating scheme, mm-hmm, at all. There was no way for Napster to make money. That wasn't part of what was going on. In fact, I'm not sure that was ever really part of their original plan.
Service plan, right.
Yeah, originally it was all just about sharing, and that, you know, they knew that the service had value, but not in a way that they could actually
monetize.
And
sure.
Although, you know, they were looking, even in the early days,
mm-hmm,
they were looking at ways to get licenses from various music labels,
right,
where they'd be able to do things like sell music files through Napster,
mm-hmm,
as well as kind of, you know, diffuse the growing problem, mm-hmm, of the RIAA looking out for copyright infringements.
Or even later on, they were talking about, you know, trying to find a way to count these downloads and tally them up and pay the recording artists and the labels and all of that for the music. So, you know, I think it's really important to mention that, because these kids really weren't out there going like, we're going to steal all the music.
Right. In fact, they were just thinking like, this is a way to share stuff. And it's a tool for music discovery, which was that was a big deal too, was the idea like, it's getting harder and harder to discover music. Radio stations might play the same, like, you know,
they're
a couple dozen tracks.
They're technically obligated to play the same like 40 tracks by their contracts. So
how do you discover new stuff if you don't have the luxury of flying off to Amsterdam every few months to listen to a band play,
right,
then how do you discover new music? If you're not, you know, you may not live in a city that has a vibrant music community, it mm-hmm. makes it really difficult.
And so, you know, although the record industry was doing fine, its profits raised 8% in 1999 over the previous year. By the end of the year, the RIAA filed a lawsuit against Napster.
Right. Right around that same time, Napster hired its first non-founding member named Ali Aidar. And then right while that was going on, RIAA was really looking at Napster as a true threat. Like, this was, if the website's hosting a few music files were bad. Napster was Darth Vader coming out to kill all the Jedi.
Right.
And so RIAA really started to concentrate on them. In fact, called Napster a giant online pirate bazaar. That's bazaar, B-A-Z-A-A-R, not bizarre as in strange. Mm-hmm. And so the thing was that as the RIAA began to focus on Napster and all this news broke about coming after Napster, that just made Napster's profile go up even more, which meant
right.
more people discovered the service, which meant that it actually got more popular than ever before. Meanwhile, the RIAA was specifically looking at charging Napster $100,000 for every copyrighted work that was infringed.
Which is a bunch.
That's a lot. Yeah, and remember, this is a service that grows incredibly every time someone new joins in, especially
sure.
if that person has files on their computer that wasn't already spread across the entire Napster landscape.
Right.
So if I join on and I happen to have my Tibetan throat singing madrigal CD that nobody else in the whole world owns and it happens to be on my computer, then suddenly I am of more value to Napster mm-hmm. because there's new stuff that no one else has yet. If I happen to have Dave Matthews' Greatest Hits, there's a chance that was already covered on Napster.
I would think so.
I don't have that album, by the way.
I'm very proud of you. I'm very proud. I don't either. That's
I'm not passing any judgment.
Dave
I'm just
Matthews.
Saying.
We all.
So, yeah, that was fun. But yeah, here's something that Eileen Richardson specifically had to say about Napster. And this comes from an interview she did with Salon, where this was after Metallica, after Lars Ulrich himself came by and dropped off this mm-hmm. huge lawsuit. Because it wasn't just the RIAA that came after Napster. Individual labels and bands also came after Napster.
Yeah, yeah.
And so she said, I think... And then in brackets, because this is not exactly what she said, but Metallica and the recording industry's actions are based on a lack of knowledge and fear. When you're afraid of something that you don't understand, you react, usually with a lawsuit. But over time, and we see this absolutely every single day, everybody's learning. We're learning about the music industry. They're learning about the internet. I'm confident that we'll get there together. Now, as it turns out, her words were not quite prophetic. She was giving a little too much credit, I think, to all sides on this issue.
Uh-huh.
I don't mean to paint the RIAA as being this evil entity. They were looking out for their interests in
a very,
very passionate way.
Yes.
Meanwhile, Napster was looking out for their interests in a very passionate way.
I think that everyone involved was being a little bit short-sighted about exactly what needed to happen.
Yeah, now,
but
there is no doubt that the music industry had not really figured out the internet yet.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, because no one had a music store that was really of any true utility at this point. And so that's why when you have a service that allows people to get what they want, they go to it. Whether
mm-hmm.
that's a piracy service or if it's one that's legitimate, doesn't matter. If you give the people what they want, that's where they're going to go. And the music industry had not yet figured out how to give the people what they wanted.
Yeah.
And so that was the problem. By the way, I still remember the days when I would actually want to buy an album because I liked the album experience.
Mm-hmm.
But even at this point in the 90s, I was one of these people. I was one of the people saying, I don't want to buy an entire album. I just like this one song.
I just like this one song, yeah.
And, I can't think of the last time, besides like a soundtrack to a musical, because jazz hands, I can't think of the last time I sat down and listened to an album from start to finish.
That's actually how I kind of usually do it myself. If I like an artist well enough, I'll buy the album and sit down and listen to it several times through, actually.
Man, but, it's been a long time. I've done that with They Might Be Giants. I've done that with them. But and Jonathan Coulton, and Marianne Call. But beyond like a few artists, I just don't like fun. No, I just went out and bought the one song.
Sure,
the one that everyone listens to. But anyway, getting back to Napster, and around 2000, they secured a round of funding from Hummer Winbald,
mm-hmm.
which installed a man named Hank Berry as the CEO of Napster. Again, another interim CEO. So Hank Berry takes over for Eileen Richardson in 2000. And his main concern was to try and resolve the legal issues that had popped up between Napster and the RIAA.
Right, right.
And other people on his management team took over the day-to-day executive decisions of keeping the company going. Mm-hmm. So really, Hank Barry was just looking at the legal issues, not mm-hmm. how to operate the company.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, you know, it's when you've got people like Dr. Dre talking directly to you about lawsuits, then it's you start. Yeah.
Well, and there were some artists who were coming out in defense.
Yeah. Limp Bizkit, Offspring. I think Chuck D was big.
Yeah. Yes, he was. he was also a big supporter of Napster. That was so there were artists on either side of the issue, obviously. 2000 was also when this was another thing that got Napster a ton of publicity, when colleges started to ban Napster.
Yeah, something I think that I read a figure that something like 40% of colleges across the U.S.
It was around by March of 2000, it was about 130 universities, but more would join.
Right.
And
it was also their biggest period of activity. They had upwards of 70 million registered users.
Yeah, and around 2.5 million people connected at any one time.
Wow.
So keep in mind, these servers could only handle a certain number of connections. They had more than one server. But in the early days, if you wanted to use the service, you would connect to the server, and then about up to around 4,999 other people could connect to that same server at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the servers could handle larger loads than others, but you know, the more you would put in there, the slower the whole service would go. So you would be connected to a server along with thousands of other people, which meant that you were limited to whatever those other people had in their share folders, right?
Sure.
So not every music file in the world is available at any given time. It all depends upon who is connected to the service at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, each server was kind of its own independent
island.
Its own
little world, and it depended on, you know, just when you signed in, what server you would hit,
and
who else would be on there, you know.
Right.
But at this time, they were running about 140 servers, I think is the estimate.
And ultimately, what their goal was to link all the servers together. So that way, if I linked to server A and Lauren linked to server B, we would still be able to exchange files. Now, in the early days, that was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
We would both need to be on server A or both be on server B for that to work. The universities and colleges also began to notice that uploads were the upload speeds were really dying on campus because people were using the service, and that
I think that by it might have been in 2001 of January, Indiana University noticed that up to 50% of its network resources were being used by Napster.
Yeah, and Oxford University really suffered because here's the thing about Oxford University: they had to pay for any data transferals that were transatlantic. So any files that were passing over the cables that go underneath the ocean that connected Europe to North America.
They got charged per byte.
Yeah, so they had to pay per byte, a certain amount per byte for that. So people on the Oxford campus who were using Napster and were downloading files directly from computers in the USA
mm-hmm.
were really driving that up.
Yeah, they joked that it would have been less expensive to have just bought the students the CDs.
Right, if the college had gone out to a music store and just filled up 400 carts with CDs and brought it back to the campus, it would have been less expensive.
This
was also around the time when this was mainly Eileen Richardson's influence here, where they were looking at incorporating more social tools in Napster, things like instant messenger, chat rooms.
Yeah, that good old IRC stuff that they were also fond of.
Yeah, and again, this was an idea to kind of help users discover new music mm-hmm. and learn more about the stuff that they're interested in. And so it was really becoming a social platform at the same time as it was under fire from the industry. And so we're getting now to the point where we need to take a quick break. But before I say that, remember, even at this point where Napster's going crazy with huge amounts of traffic, remember, at this stage, it's the most popular web service that has ever existed. It would be dwarfed by things like Facebook in the future.
Sure.
But this is before Facebook.
Yeah, at the time, connecting, you know, a few million people simultaneously.
That was a big deal.
Unheard of.
Yeah, so huge deal. Still not any way to generate revenue. But let's take a quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. on the network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Take your work on the road, and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, and now let's get back to Napster. All right, so 2000's come and gone. We're into 2001, and Napster receives an order to shut down. This is
a court order.
A court order to shut down its services because the RIAA has said that Napster is complicit in copyright infringement suits. It's not just that it is a service, it is actively helping people copyright. That's essentially what it would have to be for it to get around this whole DMCA safe harbor issue. And that's a debatable thing, but the judge kind of sided with the music industry. There was a stay in the order.
Yeah, two days later, in fact, I think, a stay was enacted.
Right, so they didn't have to shut down immediately. However, not that much longer, they would get another order to shut down, and they actually would have to do it.
Right.
And they received, right around that same time...
Yeah, during that stay, they received, $60 million investment money from Bertelsmann. Bertelsmann, of course, being a giant multimedia company that, in fact, owned a bunch of the companies that were participating in a lawsuit against Napster.
Yeah, so you have to understand, okay, so Bertelsmann is this mega multimedia company based out of Germany. All right. And it owns lots and lots of stuff, lots of different divisions.
Yeah.
And these different divisions don't necessarily talk to each other. So one division sits there and sees Napster and sees lots of potential in it as turning it into a revenue generating service.
Mm-hmm.
Another division that has nothing to do with that first division is seeing Napster as the pirate that is killing its business and it needs to go after it.
Well, I think that really, I mean, I think it was extremely savvy of Bertelsmann to be investing in them at the time because they were looking at it and they were going, this is potentially the future. This is how they are, if, you know, what they're doing right now is crappy for us, But if people are excited about music, and that's great. If we can monetize that.
I think Bertelsmann would argue that retroactively it was not a savvy move at all.
Okay. Well, sure. But you know.
They saw where the future was going. Mm-hmm. It unfortunately was the wrong time to implement it.
Yes.
Just turned out that the hornet's nest that had been stirred up was so great as to totally derail any efforts in turning Napster into a quote-unquote legitimate revenue-generating service.
Right, yeah. Well, they installed Conrad Hilbers as
the new CEO.
Yeah.
So Hank Berry steps aside.
Uh-huh. And
meanwhile, just as Conrad Hilbers was taking over, Hank Berry had just gone before Congress and asked Congress to form some sort of industry-wide license agreement for internet broadcast, similar to what radio has.
Right, sure.
And his argument was that really we're just another distribution platform, just like radio. So really we should have the same opportunity to license music the way radio does. The problem with establishing a license for every single file is that it's impossible to do.
Sure.
Because take a typical album. That album might have multiple producers on it, and each producer has some level of ownership of the tracks that are on that album.
Uh-huh.
Then you have the artists, and they also have some ownership on the tracks on that album.
Of the composition and of the actual performance.
Right.
Yeah.
So securing a license from every single copy, you know, like everyone who owns
it's
part
rough.
Of that content, it's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
They say, you know, he was saying that for one album, you might have to secure hundreds of licenses just to be able to have that one album.
Mm-hmm.
Then you multiply that across the hundreds of thousands of albums that have always existed and the new ones that are coming out every year, and you have an impossible situation. There's
right.
no way to legally follow that rule. So what
right.
needs to happen is a new legal way. He wasn't arguing.
Yeah, sure.
He wasn't arguing for piracy. He was just arguing for a new legal means to license
mm-hmm.
music. And that was getting really bogged down in Congress. So then he ends up stepping aside and Conrad Hilbers takes over. Conrad didn't have a whole long time to operate Napster before it got shut down. That was on June 11th, 2001. That's when Napster shut off its service.
Mm-hmm.
It still existed as a corporate entity.
Right.
And it started to really concentrate on finding a way to create a legal music distribution service. And I say legal with air quotes around it because Napster, again, would be arguing that what they did was perfectly legal.
They had never done anything wrong, right.
They were only, safe harbor.
Right. They were only connecting people to do illegal things.
Right. And that wasn't even the purpose of Napster. The purpose of Napster
right.
was sharing music and that, you know, it's the fact that people were using it to share music illegally. That wasn't Napster's fault, and you can argue whether or not that's naive or sincere.
Sure,
and,
sure.
That's not really our place to do that. I mean, you certainly could have used Napster in a perfectly legal means if an artist had given
full permission.
Mm-hmm. Like, I want this, you can distribute this any way you
sure.
like. I have I release all claim to it. Otherwise, I just want my music out there. Then it would have been perfectly legal to distribute that across Napster. It was the problem was there were people doing that with stuff where they didn't have that permission.
They did not have that permission. Yeah.
Now you could ask, how is this different from taking my copy of a CD that I've bought, making a copy and giving it to Lauren?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All I've done is just change the way that Lauren has received that music.
Mm-hmm.
And is it my fault that Lauren and maybe 2.4 million people I don't know got that music track? I don't know. So it got really complex.
Yeah, yeah. So then the next note that I have is in 2002 when the company was still shuttered but working. And they entered into a beta test of a secure file trading network that January.
Yeah, and that was something they were really seriously working on at the same time as trying to figure out a way to stave off the growing financial problems they were facing
mm-hmm.
as a result of these lawsuits.
Yeah, yeah. They were so serious that as of February, Bertelsmann just kind of offered to buy the company, I think for like $20 million, like not a whole lot.
It was in addition to the money they had already invested into the company,
which was $85 million.
Yeah, I think in total it was like $85 million.
Okay, but
I think
yeah.
I could be. You know, there are a lot of interesting reports on this, so it's kind of hard to follow.
Yeah, it gets a little bit timey wimey.
Yeah, exactly, wibbly wobbly. In May 2002, Sean Fanning and Conrad Hilbers both resigned.
Right. Yeah, this was John Fanning, you know, kind of tried to organize a coup from the way that I read it.
Interesting.
He was trying to oust Hummer and Hank Barry and all the venture capitalists, and there was all of this infighting within the company going on. Fanning eventually filed a lawsuit to have Barry and Hummer dismissed from the board of directors. The suit was thrown out of court, but yeah, as of May, things had gotten so bad that
that Sean Fanning, he quits.
Yeah.
Yeah, and another interesting note is that Sean Fanning apparently never drew more than just a regular, like...
paycheck, yeah.
Yeah, his paycheck was just... it was like a middle... of the company type of paycheck.
And after founding it, he worked as a grunt, as a coder.
Yeah. In fact, he apparently started getting into trouble because he was getting so many requests for interviews back when Napster was really in the news for all this legal battle stuff. He was getting so many requests for interviews, he wasn't able to meet his coding responsibilities, and he started getting in trouble from his boss.
Uh-huh.
Keeping in mind, he's the guy who built the tool.
Yeah, he's the guy who kind of technically hired his boss. So,
and now his boss is like, you kind of need to get back to work, buddy.
Yeah. But Napster denied this sale to Bertelsmann, and
it kind of just sort of dies from there.
It collapsed like a flan in a cupboard.
It was trapped like a moth in a bath. At that point, there were also the major labels were trying to launch their own services.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was called Press Play, which was launched in, I think, around 2002, and it ended in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was called MusicNet, which was also a failure. And the problem was that buying music from these services was often more trouble than what people thought it was worth. Again, it was not, it became easier to pirate music than it was to buy it. And if it's easier, people will do it.
Mm-hmm. And other companies like Kazaa and things like that were popping up.
Yeah. So you had Nutella as well. You had other file sharing services out there. They were picking up where Napster had dropped off. And so there were a lot of casualties in this whole rise and fall of Napster. And, you know, keep in mind, this is just 1999 to 2002. And
it happened. I had no idea when we started doing this that it had happened that fast.
Well, because it was such a huge name, right? Mm-hmm. You just expect that it had at least a decade worth of life.
Yeah.
And, of course, we'll get into what Napster is now in just a minute.
Okay.
But besides the fact that you had Fanning, who never drew anything more than just a regular salary, Eileen Richardson had a huge career setback. Business Week ran an article that essentially said that all of the legal problems were mainly due to the way Richardson was running the company, which was not entirely accurate. Fair to her.
Yeah, how she was running the company and how she was marketing everything.
Yeah.
Because she was very like free love about the music, and which is great, but
yeah, apparently that hit her pretty hard.
Yeah.
And also the Bertelsmann CEO, Thomas Middlehoff, was replaced. He was replaced by another CEO when that Napster deal went so sour, and plus the economy itself began to really crumble. Because keep in mind, this is post-dot-com crash, and the ramifications of that are still unfolding in 2002. So you've got the company just completely languishing. There's very little of it left. It ends up going into Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And then there's a bankruptcy auction held in 2002. This is still happening, like, right after the other.
Yeah.
And a company called Roxio purchases the assets of Napster in an auction in 2002. They also, that same company, purchased that failed music service called Press Play in 2003. And so they decided to use the kind of the cachet of Napster's name and the foundation of the Press Play service and combine them together to form Voltron. Except by Voltron, I mean a legal music service that everyone knows the name of because everyone's heard the name Napster.
Yes.
So they take some time to develop this. And the reason why it took so long is that they had to establish those licenses that Napster never could get hold of.
Right.
Napster had been trying to do that for especially the last 2 years of its existence.
Mm-hmm.
and failed. And so,
and yeah, and meanwhile, companies like Rhapsody, which was another, it wasn't a file sharing thing, but it was a music subscription plan. We're starting to.
You started to see some early examples of other music subscription services. Roxio would take years to develop this. It would actually not be until 2006. So this is 4 years after they bought the assets of Napster that they launched the free Napster service. They place Chris Gorog as the chairman and CEO of Napster. And in that time, what Napster did was it used ads to support a free web-based streaming experience. Now, you could stream any song that was in Napster's catalog a maximum of three times.
Right. After that, you had to either purchase the song or
never listen to it again. At least not on Napster.
Right, right.
Yeah, you had to purchase the song. Now, nice thing about it is that you could purchase a DRM-free version of the MP3 of whatever song it was. So you didn't have to worry about, okay, well, you can buy this song, but you can only play it on three machines, and after that, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, because that was one of the big problems of early DRM with music, was that it would limit how many machines you could put it on. And, here's the thing about technology, folks. Our stuff gets out of date, and we want to replace it occasionally. So if you tell me that I can only load this on three machines, I'm like, well, that's
only going to last like 5 years.
Yeah, then I have to buy the song again? What's the deal? And this is where you bring into question, like, all right, you don't own the song because you didn't make it, but you own the opportunity to experience that song within the realm of a specific kind of license.
It's licensed for home use.
Their argument might be, well, I want to use it at home, but none of the things I have will play it now.
Right.
It's complicated. And in fact, we could probably do a full episode about that. We've talked about it in previous ones. Well, so 2006, they launch. Chris Gorog is the chairman and CEO. They try to get it moving, but it doesn't really catch on. For one thing, at this point, they're starting to really come into competition with iTunes. By now,
right.
iTunes is really a thing.
Uh-huh.
And so from 2006 to 2010, that was Napster's existence. But in 2010, Gorog ends up stepping down, and the president of Napster also steps down, and Best Buy purchases Napster. So the Napster COO, Christopher Allen, becomes the general manager of Napster, because now it's owned by Best Buy. It's no longer a thing that Roxio has. And his reporting relationship is to a Best Buy senior executive.
Right.
So there's a new sheriff in town, in a sense. And from 2010 to 2011, it's run as a Best Buy company. And in 2011, Rhapsody, which Lauren mentioned just a minute ago, acquires Napster and folds it into its own streaming music service. So Rhapsody and Napster are buddy-buddy.
Yeah, I think that Rhapsody had been in close affiliation with Best Buy at the time anyway.
Yes.
I think that was the official service for the Best Buy line of MP3 players back when that was a thing.
Yep, and Napster still exists. Now, granted, keep in mind, the Napster we're talking about now, really, it has very little connection to the Napster that was in the first half of this podcast.
Yeah, it's a purely subscription service. You can use it to download or stream music
to different devices.
To different devices, mobile. You know, it's got a sleek looking interface.
Yeah, and you can listen to it like if you have a compatible home entertainment system, you can listen to it on that. You can listen to it on like I said, like a MP3 players,
tablets,
smartphones.
But it's more along the line of something like Pandora. Or Spotify.
Although you have far more control than you would on Pandora.
Oh, right. And when you subscribe to it, you cut out all the ads and all that fancy stuff.
So. In fact, you have to subscribe to it. You can have a free 14-day trial, as I recall.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In the United States, I can't speak for everywhere in the world, but in the United States, the current subscription rate as of the recording of this podcast is $9.99 per month.
Yeah.
And they have apps for Android, iOS, BlackBerry, Windows Phone 7. They have extra features like tailored playlists that have been formed by various, either, sometimes they're bands or an artist, or sometimes it's like a music critic for a magazine will make a playlist and then they make it available on this, so that way you can listen to the music that people cooler than you are listening to.
Right.
And that, by the way, for me, that's everybody. I'm not saying like you are cooler than I am. I know you knew that already. I'm just letting you know that I also know that. So That's a thing.
I will go, especially music-wise, I will lump myself into that category as well.
Yeah, but, I mean, I was not aware of Neutral Milk Hotel until years after they were a thing. That's the kind of guy I am. But I was on board with Mumford & Sons before any of you folks knew who they were. Besides, unless Mumford & Sons is listening to this podcast, in which case they probably knew about it before I did.
Probably. It's likely. But anyway.
But yeah, they also had the Rhapsody radio station. So that's more like Pandora, you know, and they have their own kind of discovery algorithms as well so that you can find music that if you already like a certain kind of music, you can
recommend.
Other.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting. If you go back all the way back to the beginning days of Napster and you look at some of the things that Eileen Richardson said, it's the very basis for music discovery and like Pandora.
Yeah.
The idea, she actually says in that interview in Salon that if you like a certain artist, you should be able to find other music that's similar to that artist, which is exactly what Pandora is all about, that musical genome project.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting that she was looking ahead and she was seeing a future that wouldn't really come to maturity for almost a decade.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways Napster was approaching the industry in an aggressively incorrect way.
And the industry was reacting in a very knee-jerk way.
Uh-huh.
So the combination of the two meant that you were going to have nothing but a collision.
Yeah, yeah. But also, yeah, just the internet infrastructure was not quite there yet to provide monetization for this kind of thing. And so, you know, all of the ideas that they had were really sound and just...
But really what I think it is that the interesting thing to me is that it really created the whole peer-to-peer approach.
Yeah.
I mean, there were other peer-to-peer
services,
protocols that were coming into being right around the same time as Napster. But Napster was the one that thrust it into the spotlight.
Right.
And, you know, peer-to-peer is a completely legitimate way to get information from one computer to another computer. It doesn't have to be for nefarious purposes or piracy or whatever. And so I'm very thankful that Napster existed as a way to kind of get that as a thing. I mean, without it, we might have gone a few more years before anyone really realized the potential for peer-to-peer transmissions. So that was something very important in this whole Napster business.
All right, guys, that wraps up this classic episode of Tech Stuff. Hope you enjoyed it. And if you have any suggestions for future topics, something that I have not covered or maybe I need to revisit, let me know. Send me a message on Facebook or Twitter. The handle we use at both of those is TechStuffHSW. And I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced.
Bring it on.
Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit nfl.com/schedule-release to learn more.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.